Yes, and thank you. So now I'd like to introduce our next guest here in the studio here at NYU Langone, Dr. Dan Sperling. Dan is a colleague, a friend. He currently serves as the medical director and chief of interventional radiology at both the New Jersey Institute of Radiology in Carlstadt, New Jersey, and the Sperling Prostate Center in New York City. He specializes in MRI, that's magnetic resonance imaging, which he uses for tumor detection, targeted biopsies, prostate mapping, and treatment planning. He truly is a pioneer in the field of MR-guided prostate treatment, including a revolutionary new treatment, which is MR-guided prostate laser ablation. It's a procedure that he's helped to develop. I've had the pleasure over the last couple months of working together with Dr. Sperling on patients who I feel that this treatment really is their best treatment for prostate cancer. So, Dan, a pleasure to welcome you to the Men's Health Show.
Thanks, Herb. It's a real pleasure to be here and to have the opportunity to discuss some of the new technologies that are now available for both diagnostic evaluation of the prostate using prostate gland, using MRI, as well as new interventions we can use with MRI guidance.
Well, I'll tell you something, Dan. You know, and I go back a bit longer than you and Dr. Shaw. You know, I did my training in urology. I started in 1979. And finished in 1985. So let me sort of set the stage for all of our listeners out there on the Men's Health Show, that when I was a resident, we didn't have PSA, and we really didn't have a way to diagnose prostate cancer early in its natural history. So this was the typical scenario. A patient came in, maybe in their mid-50s, 60s, and, you know, all of a sudden their back was hurting. And, you know, they felt, God, maybe I sprained myself, you know, when I was planting the trees. And they get an x-ray, and what do they have? Metastatic prostate cancer. That was the sort of the scenario day in, day out. It was the very rare patient where they presented, actually they were asymptomatic, because at the time that we can cure prostate cancer is when it's localized to the gland. And in that setting, there really are no symptoms. So, you know, many men weren't inclined to have a digital rectal exam. And unfortunately, many of the primary care physicians were not that skilled at performing the test. It wasn't really a routine part of the exam. So it was the rare patient who had what we call the prostate nodule, and typically a diagnosis of prostate cancer was a death sentence. And it was the second most common cause of cancer-related mortality, a great deal of morbidity. So that puts us in the sort of mid-1980s, right? And then there were, I think, two things that really transformed the way that we diagnosed and treated prostate cancer. One was PSA, which is prostate-specific antigen. And this became widely accepted as a way to screen for prostate cancer. And second was, once we found these early cancers, and I had the pleasure of working very closely with Patrick Walsh at Hopkins, because when you found an early cancer, and you had sort of a standard radical prostatectomy to remove the prostate, it was fraught with complications. Virtually every patient had erectile dysfunction, and a significant subset had incontinence. And what Walsh did in my role was actually working out where the nerves were for mediating erectile function. And they happened to travel very close to the prostate. Nobody knew that, because they're microscopic. If you took the prostate out without knowing where these nerves were, they were inadvertently damaged, and men were impotent. So defining their precise location in specific patients, in selected patients with minimal to moderate disease that likely didn't pass through the capsule, the surface, we were able to preserve the function in many patients. Now, when I say many, We may. It depends upon the candidate. If you have a patient who's in their early 50s with a low-risk disease, and now you're talking about having done thousands of these operations and you're honest about the outcomes, you could preserve potency in 70% of men. But you don't preserve it to the point of their – they don't return to their preoperative status. They are simply able to have intercourse with assistance with medications. You have a 70-year-old, that goes to like 30-40%. But what happened was is – we ended up diagnosing early cancers, and we felt that we had a very good treatment for them. But when we look at PSA screening, right? So the real problem with PSA screening was what? It lacks sensitivity and specificity. So its main problem is it's prostate specific and not prostate cancer specific. So what happens is there are many men who have an elevated PSA who ultimately don't have prostate cancer, right? So what happened was in the screening process, we ended up with a large, in fact, I think the number is 1 million men a year have an elevated PSA and go to a biopsy. So maybe Dan, and again, Dan is a radiologist. He's an interventional radiologist. And so most radiologists don't have experience taking care of patients. They'll simply do an X-ray test and sort of send a report. Dan has been much more engaged in the process. We're going to bring Dan in a minute. I just want to set the stage. So what we would do is we would then do a random biopsy, right? Because imaging was worthless at the time, and you're going to tell us in a minute what have been the major advances. So now we get this test that has that we're now, it's positive in many men who don't have prostate cancer. And then what do? We take a needle and we randomly, just like blindly, you know, take 12 samples. And the real problem is this. You know, they say 30% of men, if you take their prostate and really look critically, you're going to find prostate cancer. But only 3% of men die of it. So that means the majority of these cancers are insignificant, and we wish we never would have detected them. But what happens is when we do these random biopsies, right, we may detect them. And the other problem is there may be a big cancer, and you miss it. So, you know, if you look through and if you just focus for the audience the last month and look at if you've been reading the newspapers, you've been listening to the television, what are the two articles that came out? One, that screening is worthless, and treatment is worthless. So there's a lot of criticism, and if anyone has listened to the Men's Health Show over the last several months, you'll see our response, that the study that was used to condemn screening was so flawed, it just never should have been published. And the study that showed that surgery had no benefit, that was so flawed, it should never be published. However, I think what we have to sit back and do is say, okay, their screening has resulted in 40% decline in mortality. We know from the Scandinavians and their study that surgery does benefit a subset of men. But I think we have to reflect and say what we're doing, while we've made some progress, boy, we got a long way to go. So I think one of the major advances is imaging. So Dan, give the audience a sense on what we learned from an MRI, let's say 5 years ago, and what you and other leaders in the field, how this MRI has been advanced. So now we can begin to identify those cancers that are significant that we want to treat. So what's been so give us a sense of MRI when you did it 5 years ago and why it wasn't useful, and the MRI today that you're doing that is really giving us a much better picture about the site and the aggressiveness of the disease.
Sure. Well, MRI, about 5 years ago, all we were able to do was a T2-weighted sequence, which means we're able to just look at the prostate gland from an anatomic perspective and see the basically the peripheral zone of the outer part of the prostate gland replaced by dense tumor. It did not really yield a high degree of sensitivity and specificity, and because of that, really MRI got a bad reputation at that stage. Now, in the recently, we've developed two additional ways of looking at the prostate gland, and combined with the older method, we have now three ways of looking at tumor in the gland, which is called multiparametric prostate MRI. We can look at function. We can see angiogenesis now, where blood vessels we know form in tumor tissue at a rapid rate compared to surrounding normal prostate tissue. We can actually see that, map it out, and make it look like a bullseye on the MRI. It's very easy for anyone to really see tumor with that sequence. We can see the dynamic blood flow. The other way that we could see tumor, which is very significant, is called diffusion weight imaging. We know that in tumor tissue, cells divide more rapidly. So you have cells clustering together. Cells have cell membranes, and they restrict water movement through tissue. So with diffusion weighted imaging, we can actually see things on a microscopic level. We could see that water is moving through that area more slowly. So converting the MRI into what we could call a virtual microscope, we can actually see tumor at that level. And we can actually determine aggressiveness of tumor at this stage, even determining if it's a Gleason 7, a Gleason 6 tumor, measuring what we call pixel volume or density of the tumor with special methods. So it's extremely sophisticated. The yield now is over 95% with the newer technology. We don't need to use an endorectal coil. It's much more comfortable for the patients. And really, the results have been phenomenal.
So we've seen, and have we also seen an improvement in the magnets? I mean, is the magnet that we use in the MRI today much more sophisticated, giving us much better images than even 5 years ago?
Sure. The MRIs have become more advanced. They're faster. They're higher gradients. We're now using 3 Tesla. I almost use exclusively what's called a 3T MRI. So the resolution or the quality of the imaging is much higher. In addition, we use a very specialized software processing. So after the MRI is done, we take those images and we process them through this analysis, and the computer actually gives us information and will pinpoint direct areas that are very highly suspicious for tumor. So this new functional analysis is enabled by the newer software technologies that we use.
So it's important to sort of have a perspective on this, because you talked about the T2-weighted image. Now, the T2-weighted image, which is all we had 5 years ago, had the same issues of specificity as a PSA. The only difference was is the PSA cost $50, and an MRI to get the same sort of lack of specificity, meaning you could have infection, you could have bleeding, you could even have some benign enlargement. And this could mimic the signal that you'd get from a prostate cancer. As you said, by looking at the diffusion-weighted imaging, by looking at the increase in blood flow in certain regions, you now can put all this together and with a much higher probability determine where that cancer is. So there are two studies. And I must say, if I go back 3 years ago, I never got an MRI because I just didn't see the value. And I will tell you today, I never do a prostate biopsy without having the MRI as a roadmap. And I don't do a radical prostatectomy, which is what I do predominantly in my patients who have localized disease, at least today. And that's even evolving based upon a lot of the work that you've done, is I use it to see how close the cancer is to the outer surface to determine the prudence of trying to save those nerves that are very close without compromising cancer control. But you're very familiar with that European trial where what they did was they said, okay, and we talked about this as we discussed a patient today. The standard of care today, right, is what? You get a PSA and it's elevated. You get this what we call transrectal ultrasound guided biopsy, where we take 12 random samples. We have no idea where the cancer is. There's really no signal where the cancer is, and we put those needles in. Now, the study that was done in Europe said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take the MRI, right? And where we see the abnormality on the MRI, We're going to fix that in our brain so that when we go ahead and we do the ultrasound biopsy, we're going to say, okay, I think this was over here. We call that cognitive co-registration. And we say, okay, we'll take a couple SNPs from there. And then they took 12 SNPs from the, as we normally would, as the standard of care. So how did you interpret? I bet you we interpret it in a similar way in terms of the value of biopsying where you see the abnormality on its important multiparametric MR versus just going ahead and randomly putting 12 needles, which is the standard of care. So how did you interpret what I think is a very important study that has been sort of underappreciated in the urology community?
Well, the way I would interpret that is that in terms of identifying the primary focus or the index lesion of the tumor that's most aggressive, you really need to visualize that tumor if you're doing a biopsy and sampling. You want your doctor to actually see the most critical area and to have that sample to get accurate staging. So it's very important. We don't yet know if random sampling is always going to be around, but we do know that we want to at least target and take a biopsy sample of the most aggressive tumor. So for instance, a number of months ago, I had a patient who was in his 60s. He had about four different sessions of biopsies, many, many needle sticks. It was very uncomfortable for him. His PSA kept going up. Actually, it went at over 30. I did one MRI guided biopsy, one session. I stuck two needles in and sampled that area, and it turned out to be a Gleason 8 tumor that was extending, a very aggressive tumor that was starting to extend through the capsule. That was life-saving for that patient. He was able to get treatment instead of just being followed and biopsied because it was an area that it was very hard to reach with the traditional biopsy method, the ultrasound-guided biopsy method. So it's critical to first be able to identify these tumors, and then even smaller tumors, if there is one present, you want to be able to sample and accurately stage the tumor. You want to know how aggressive the most aggressive part of the tumor is, and we're able to see that now and sample it.
See, one of the concerns, and that is that prostate cancer is multifocal. So so you don't just have one lesion. In some cancers, you may have up to 10. But what we're learning, and we have a big paper that we're getting ready to publish, is that many of those multifocal sites are of a very low aggressiveness, and they have little clinical significance. And if you sit back, and those who are critical of screening, right, PSA screening, and those who are critical of radical prostatectomy, what their real criticism is that we are overdiagnosing and overtreating disease that would never harm the patient. Now, you can't argue with the fact that we are decreasing the mortality by 40%. So there is a tangible benefit, but there are a lot of men. In order to cure some, there are many men who are undergoing treatment with really little benefit. So the real question is, or the challenge, I say, is can we find a way to diagnose only those cancers that are what we call clinically significant, right? So in that study, what they showed is that if you did the 12-core biopsy and you compared it to just sort of doing this cognitive co-registration, that if you don't do all of those random biopsies, you're going to miss about 20-30% of the cancers. But it just so happened that all of those cancers that you missed were small and presumably unimportant. So one way that we can sort of solve the criticism of screening, universal screening and aggressive treatment is to simply say, can we identify those significant lesions and treat those, right? Now, what we then do is what we call a cognitive co-registration, because I'll tell you, it's not so easy to do the biopsies in the MRI machine. But I think, and this is where I think you've played such an important role in helping define this field. The question is, I imagine if you had to do 12 biopsies in your MR machine, that would be so time consuming that it would be impractical. But now, if you only have to say, okay, here's the abnormality, I'm going to put and biopsy that under MR guidance, then you're going to be able to avoid all those unnecessary biopsies. So take us through a MR-guided biopsy. Maybe you do this quite extensively. Maybe take a patient as an example in terms of you sort of alluded to one a minute ago. Sort of, you know, the typical patient that you're doing the MR-guided biopsy. How long does it take? How uncomfortable is it? And how technically difficult it is to perform. So give us sort of a perspective, because I think this is going to be an important way that we're going to keep impacting on mortality, but at the same time decreasing the number of unimportant cancers. So what's an MR-guided biopsy like? Take us quickly through it, and then we'll take a break.
Okay, so the preparation for an MRI-guided biopsy is the same as for an ultrasound. You take antibiotics ahead of time. The patient then comes into the MRI room, lies down on their belly during the study, and we have specialized, almost robotic hardware or plastic tube the size of an index finger that gets inserted into the rectum and has special coordinates or knobs on it. So while the individual is lying on his belly in the MRI machine, I leave the room and I start playing around with my computer software, and right. I can actually put the cursor directly on the computer screen directly where I see the tumor, and I can see that exactly where the tumor is. Then the computer generates special coordinates. I go back into the room. I just turn the knobs exactly where the computer tells me to turn them to, and then I sample and put a needle directly through this plastic tube that's through the rectum. I stick it through there into the prostate, and I actually can image the needle, since it's safe in the MRI machine, it's made of titanium, we can image that in the scanner, and we know we've actually hit the tumor.
So it's very different than when I get the MR image and I say in ultrasound, trying to three-dimensional reconstruct or superimpose it. You do this, you see that, and in real time, you put a needle right into that prostate.
Correct. I can actually go directly into using the native imaging, I can directly target the lesion. Now, it's a difficult procedure in terms of training. It takes quite a long time to learn. There's a lot of intricacies. If the patient moves during the procedure, it may throw off the coordinates. So you can't just go by the computer software. You have to be able to understand the anatomy and think very three-dimensionally to be able to do a good job. So you really want someone who has a tremendous amount of experience with this. You could get false negatives or false negatives.
And I will tell you, and we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back and talk about what do we do when we find this focal lesion. But I will tell you, at this point in time, there are very, very few interventional radiologists that have this skill. But I think it's going to be a very important skill to acquire, because I think we're sort of ready to experience sort of a paradigm shift in how we approach prostate cancer. We're not going to abandon screening. We're not going to abandon aggressive intervention, but we're going to have to get better at screening, and then we're going to find some men that might be candidates or best treated with a truly minimally invasive approach, which would be focal therapy. So again, this is Herb Laporte, your host this evening of the Men's Health Show. We're talking about prostate cancer and how imaging is likely to transform how we screen, how we detect, and how we treat prostate cancer. We've got one of the leading experts, Dan Sperling, interventional radiologist here in the studio. We're going to talk about the advances that imaging will allow us when we come back.
This is Dr. Radio, Sirius XM 81, and on the Sirius XM app for smartphones.
Welcome back to the Men's Health Show on Dr. Radio's Sirius XM 81. I'm Herb Lepore, your host this evening. I'm joined here in the studio by Dr. Dan Sterling, who is the medical director and chief of interventional radiology at both the New Jersey Institute of Radiology in Carlstadt, New Jersey, and the Sperling Prostate Center in New York City. He is one of the leading experts in MR imaging of the prostate and also in MR laser ablation of the prostate, which we're now going to direct our discussion. But, you know, let me just emphasize to those listening today to the Men's Health Show. This is the standard of care. So the standard of care is men get a PSA. If it's elevated and men have a 10-year life expectancy, then the next step is to undergo a transrectal ultrasound-guided biopsy. And again, the urologist will randomly obtain 12 biopsies from the prostate, and that is the standard of care. What we're talking about is what I believe is going to be the next step in how we screen, diagnose, and treat prostate cancer. So again, this has all yet to be validated, but I believe that we have to rethink how we treat prostate cancer. Look, I disagree with the article that came out and said that screening is of no value. I disagree with the United States Preventive Task Force Service that said no one should be screened, okay? I disagree with the article that said surgery doesn't have a role. And I can defend what we're doing as progress, but I can't defend that we continue to get a PSA, that we continue to randomly biopsy the prostate, and then offer treatment. And really, the treatment that we can offer them is you do nothing, or you either totally destroy the prostate, or you try to totally remove the prostate. But I think common sense dictates that there's a better way. And what Dr. Sperling and I are not only talking about, but we're working collaboratively to help define, is a better way. But it isn't as though you should then go to your urologist tomorrow and say, hey, wait a second, wait. I just listened to the Men's Health Show. Why aren't you getting an MR guided biopsy and then finding my tumor and ablating it? I'd have to say that we are on the cutting edge, and hopefully what we're talking about is going to help transform the paradigm. But we have a long way to go before we know exactly the ideal candidate for this type of novel approach. But that's where we're heading. So let's assume that we get a PSA. Now, let's assume that the next step is you don't do that random biopsy. You now get an MRI. And there's evidence to suggest that if your MRI is absolutely normal, you probably don't need to do a biopsy, although standard of care today is to do the biopsy. But let's say you see an abnormality and you then put a needle directly into that lesion and it's prostate cancer. So today you can tell the patient, okay, we think that you have a low-grade cancer. We're not so sure that, you know, you're going to live long enough to have a problem. So you don't do nothing. You say surveillance. We'll keep, you know, biopsying you every year, which is not, you know, terribly simple on the patient. Or, hey, we could take your prostate out. I've done that 4,500 times, and I've done that in many men that I've felt that this was their absolute best option. But now, Dan, tell me, what is the, and you've done about 50 of these so far. I know there's a lot of interest. So tell me the treatment so the next step in is now you can image this lesion. Maybe talk about the different ways that you can destroy it and what you think is going to be the best way with the least complications to ablate these lesions that we're now detecting. So what are the different ways that you can destroy tissue? And today, what do you think is the best way to approach that single lesion?
Well, the first step in really doing an effective ablation or treatment of the specific MRI lesion is that you get an MRI and use that to guide you. If you just use ultrasound, which certain technologies have been using for many years to just do focal ablation, you're actually not going to know what you're hitting. You're not going to know you're hitting the tumor. So treatments like cryotherapy, where you freeze it with a tumor, or high flow, which is high intensity focused ultrasound, those treatments are guided by ultrasound and therefore are limited in the sense that you can't actually define where the tumor is. If you want get a treatment, you want it done with MRI guidance. You want to be in the MRI scanner and have the whatever you're using to destroy the tumor being guided directly at the lesion. Right now, with MRI-guided laser, we can actually target the specific tumor, and we've just put a very small laser beam, a small plastic fiber, directly in the tumor itself, and then in real time, so while the laser is firing, the patient doesn't feel anything, and we can actually see on a monitor how much of the tumor we're destroying and protect critical structures like the nerves, so we can prevent impotence, and we can prevent incontinence and protect the urethra. We actually have safety mechanisms in the software that if we reach a certain critical threshold of heating, the laser will actually shut off on itself automatically. So it's a very safe procedure and very targeted. We only use local anesthesia in the procedure itself. It takes about an hour on average. So.
No, and you made a very important point, and that is that we can see these tumors. We can image them on MRI. We cannot image them on ultrasound. So if you're going to treat based upon the ultrasound, at least where technology is today, we may talk about in the last few seconds, you know, what may be a way that we can simplify this. But today, the only way that we can image the cancer and really put the needle into that image is under MR guidance. So then the thing is that, well, if the way that you could image it is with the MRI, then is it, how can we then actually in real time destroy that lesion? And the only way you can actually destroy it in real time is to actually see it in real time, and that's using the MR. So today, if you want to do HIFU, which is to destroy the prostate with heat, or to freeze it, which are options that we've done, you're not going to be able to actually destroy that discrete lesion. You're going to have to say, well, maybe I'll destroy half the prostate, or I think the lesion is here on ultrasound. So today, we really have to use MR guidance. And I meant, so what is it about the laser that makes it sort of the preferred way to destroy tissue, the cancer, in the MR machine? I mean, could you get a cryotherapy, and could you sort of figure out a way to destroy that in the MR machine, or is laser the really only way today that you can ablate tissue in the actual scanner?
That's a great question. Cryotherapy or freezing, the way that I've actually participated in procedures using while the patient's in the MRI machine using freezing or cryotherapy, it's still very good. You can actually target the tumor. But we know that once you drop below 0 degrees, you can't actually see how much tissue you're destroying. So you will actually end up, you're going to have a higher profile of side effects. More side effects can occur because you have to destroy a larger amount of tissue. You can't calibrate it as well. So after 0 degrees in freezing, you lose your margins. You can't do a precise ablation. With laser, we can convert the MRI into a virtual thermometer. It's called actually MRI thermometry. So we can actually calibrate and measure specific degrees in real time and calibrate exactly up to 1 millimeter inside exactly how much tumor we're destroying and prevent then in real time destroying or damaging any sensitive structures that may be nearby. So it's that MRI thermometry is a unique component to laser, is not available for any other technology that allows you to target any focus anywhere in the prostate gland with precision of up to 1 millimeter.
And I've watched you do this. It is really amazing. Is that it's the built-in safety of the MRI, because you can sit back and say, okay, so here's the lesion, right? You say, okay, all you have to do is on your computer screen simply identify the rectum, identify the nerves, identify the urethra, and you know in real time, to a tenth of a degree, whether or not that energy is coming anywhere near a critical structure. And also in real time, you can actually watch the heat effect, right, from the laser of that lesion, and basically before your very eyes, see it disappear. Now, when I talk to a patient, and remember, you're talking to someone who has done 41, when the highest volume prostate prostate cancer surgeons in the world, right? And I still believe that for many patients, the radical prostatectomy is still the best treatment option. But I believe that there is a subset, and I think an increasing subset as we get better imaging, where this is going to be a very attractive and reasonable option. You know, I think a lot of people talk about personalized medicine. And they sort of talk about personalized medicine is about the genetics. So we're going to figure out what genes you have, and then we're going to target the treatment. But I think personalized medicine is what are the priorities of a patient. I mean, there are some patients who, if there is any remote possibility that you left cancer with them, they will be at total unease, and that will not be an acceptable option. Ablation's not for them. There are some men who the possibility of erectile dysfunction is overwhelming. And you may say, listen, I think that I can, you know, add 3-4 years to your life on average, right? And they'll say, but if I don't have my erections for those 25 years, I ain't interested in those 3 years. And some people will say, hey, you know what? Is there a pretty good chance that this won't get me? Well, if that's the case, let me just do active surveillance. Just keep following me because I'm willing to take those risks because, you know, I then the cancer because I don't want to encroach on my quality. So what I tell the patient who is considering focal therapy, and so if people out there have had a recent diagnosis of prostate cancer, you have to realize this targeted ablation is not for everyone. There are some cancers that are really multifocal that are more aggressive. That this is just on the basis of the cancer. It doesn't even matter what your goals are. That this is just not, it's contradicting. It's just not for you. But the person who sort of accepts an ablation is saying, hey, wait a minute, I got a dominant cancer here. I feel uncomfortable about this following it. I'm willing to accept the fact that you're likely to leave cancer behind that we don't think is an issue. That addresses the whole issue of over-treatment, right? At the same time, they're also willing to say, I'm willing to be followed. And maybe they need to be followed every year with imaging. Maybe it's every 2 years. We don't know. But it has to be that mindset that says, in order to minimize my complications of treatment, but to at least address the significant cancer that the screening has detected, then I think this is a reasonable option. It has to be viewed as experimental. It has to be viewed as unproven. But we have to take a step back and say, wait a second, there was just a study that said surgery is no better than no treatment. So how much have we proven? I disagree with that study. It was terribly flawed, but somehow it got into the New England Journal of Medicine, right? So give me an example, maybe over the last couple weeks. Maybe we're getting close to the end of the show. We've got just only about 2.5 minutes left. Maybe give me a patient that quickly that you thought this was a perfect candidate, and then we'll wrap it up.
I had a patient in his late 60s, around 67 years old, who came in to me. He was in his second marriage, had a younger wife. His sexual function was very important to him. He actually had a random biopsy with ultrasound guidance, and he only had one of the 12 cores were positive, with a lower percentage of cancer. He wanted to get treatment. He did not want to just leave this and do active surveillance, which we could have just done with MRI. We didn't have to do biopsy, serial biopsies. But he wanted to get something done. He couldn't. The psychological burden of knowing he had cancer sitting there without doing anything was just too much for him. On the other hand, his sexual function was very, very important to him. So the laser was very appealing to him. You know, this is a guy that we were able to effectively just ablate that particular area. There is possibility there could be a small tumor for something in the future, little areas of tumor that could occur. But we're going to follow him with close remark follow-up with the active surveillance. And if anything new should occur, we'll actually find it on time. His sexual function has been 100% maintained. He's actually able to have sexual relations the next day, and he actually went for a 5-mile run the next day as well. So I recommend doing kind of going for a run the next day necessarily, but the true fact is people feel very good after the procedure.
And I think then what is very important is that person had a random 12-core biopsy. He only had one tiny speck of cancer on the biopsy. So you didn't know if this was the tip of the iceberg or whether it was truly an unimportant cancer. The fact that you were able to image it meant it was a significant size that treatment was warranted. So this is we're coming to the end of the show. We talked about cranberry juice and urinary tract infections. We had a great discussion on kidney stones, and then wrapping it up, what I see is the next frontier in treating prostate cancer. I think imaging is going to be critically important. We're going to find a subset of men who a target approach is going to be the best approach. And Dan, it's been you've made important contributions in the field. It's been a true pleasure working with you on many cases. And for everybody, stay tuned to the Men's Health Show, because this is where you're going to hear it first. So good evening, and we'll catch you next week.